From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we'll learn about a new project which hopes to answer some of the more difficult ethical quandaries presented by big data collection.
Plus, we'll talk about cybersecurity and internet-connected devices, from your fitness tracker to your car.
Then, how a tiger moth's ability to defend against its greatest predator has impacted its evolution.
Can you live through a bat attack or not? That's where these anti-bat defenses really come into play. They help the moths survive that intense predatory selective pressure from the bats.
And filmmaker David Alvarado explains why he's always been fascinated by Bill Nye.
The way of looking at the world where you care about the environment, you can understand the natural order of the universe through these fun and simple ideas, for me was just like, discovering a treasure.
Lake Effect is next, but first to the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. When you sign up for Facebook, Twitter, or really any kind of social media site, you're often asked to agree to the company's terms and conditions. In many cases, this means allowing them to use the information they gather from your use of their platform, but it often doesn't specify how that information will be used.
There are a lot of ethical questions when it comes to how we use big data, and a new research project is hoping to answer at least some of them.
Michael Zimmer is the director of the Center for Information Policy Research, which is joining up with five other institutions for a four-year project studying the various ethical issues surrounding big data.
The project is called PERVADE, or Pervasive Data Ethics for Computational Research, and it just received a $3 million grant from the National Science Foundation. Dr. Zimmer sat down with me to talk about the project and the kind of research he'll be doing. Michael Zimmer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So what is PERVADE?
PERVADE is a project of a collaboration of six different universities. We're trying to look at the ethical implications of what big data research. You might have heard stories about researchers looking at large data sets of Twitter data or looking at Instagram photos and trying to guess whether or not someone is gay or straight. And there's all kinds of interesting ethical implications of how researchers are using this public data, and we're trying to understand that better.
So when we're talking about big data, what all is included inside of that term?
Well, almost anything. A lot of times we think about social media data, so all my Facebook posts or the photos I put on Facebook or in Twitter or on Instagram. But it's also transactional data. It could be from banks or insurance companies. It could be data from fitness trackers or your iPhone. So really one of the key goals of the big data movement is to try to use as much data as possible to help make decisions and predict things about the world.
So when I was looking at some of the information about PERVADE, one of the terms that comes up a lot is stakeholders and the idea of the different people involved in these interactions. So who are the stakeholders?
Yeah, one of the big things we're focusing on is trying to have a much broader approach to understanding the ethical implications. A lot of researchers, even like myself, have spent time just examining the ethics. But what we're trying to do with this project is involve the researchers, the actual subjects whose data is being used, the ethical review boards at universities that might be doing this, the companies whose data is being used, and even policymakers and government agencies who might be trying to regulate this. So we're trying to bring everyone to the table so we can come up with the real usable solutions in this domain.
So when we're talking about regulators, that's a term that kept coming up that seems so oddly specific and yet also broad. So when we look at people who are regulating how data is being used, generally who are those people?
There's probably two different ways to look at it. In terms of university researchers that engage in a lot of this work, we have ethical review boards on our campuses who do some regulation to make sure we're getting consent and we're protecting subject privacy and those kinds of concerns. But there's also increasing use of this data by companies. So Facebook might use data to test different things on their platform. So then you might see someone like the FTC getting involved on whether or not they're protecting users' privacy, whether or not they're keeping their promises that they have in their privacy policies.
And when we talk about users, of course, users are you and I, anyone whose data might be used for anything. right now, when we look at how big data is used, do we have any guarantees as to how it can be used and how it can't be used right now? Like, if let's use Facebook as an example.
That's one of the real struggles that we have, is that oftentimes the terms of service that we agree to give companies pretty much an open book in terms of what they might use of that data. Typically, it's for good reasons. They're just testing a different color on the interface or a different way of presenting a photo, and they just want to see how different users react to it. But then there could be, you know, more pernicious examples. You may have heard of the Facebook emotional contagion case from a few years ago, where they were adjusting people's news feeds on whether it had happy news feeds or sad news feeds and seeing how that affected people's mood. And there are some interesting scientific reasons for that study, but these are the kinds of things we want to make sure that users really understand, and it's not just buried in the terms of service that something like this could happen to them.
Well, that in and of itself seems a little, one might say, unethical.
Right.
You're leading a number of sub-projects.
Correct.
What are those focused on?
We're looking at a couple of different aspects. Two of the projects that I'm going to be most involved in, one is looking at researchers themselves. So one of the challenges in this area is that a lot of the research are being done by computer scientists or data scientists who don't have a long tradition of addressing ethical issues in their work. They're not used to working with humans. They're used to working with data. But now we're seeing a much closer connection between humans and their data. So one of the things I'll be doing is trying to talk with and interview and survey researchers in this domain to get a sense of how do they feel about the ethical implications, what kind of training have they had, what kind of steps might they be taking to deal with these challenges. Another project I'm going to look at is actually how we share data. And one of the big mandates across universities and even government is having open data sets. And what does it mean that if we're going to start sharing data, if that data might have personal information in it, or whether or not users understand that data used for one piece of research might be shared and used for someone else's research. So we just want to try to get a sense of what's going on in that area.
I would actually like to take a step back because, of course, we use this term data so frequently, and it does seem to be a specific word and yet also a very broad word. So when you're talking about data, when we're talking about the things that we're sharing, what does that include? Because I think a lot of people hear the term data and they go, it's a kind of amorphous blob of a term.
Yeah, data has tended to include everything now, which means it almost doesn't count for anything. So we're actually using the term pervasive data. And what we mean by that is not just a single data set or a piece of data that happened to be collected. So my car is parked out on the street right now, and that's a piece of data that maybe the city of Milwaukee might be able to collect. But pervasive data is the fact that, you know, through technology, my car might be constantly tracked, and there might be a GPS trail on my phone for everywhere my car goes, every day, all day long, no matter who's driving. And that's where we're trying to get more in touch with this, what we're calling pervasiveness, because there's data being collected all the time, all around us, and we often don't even know that it's happening. So we're very interested in social media data, increasingly interested in fitness data because we're wearing fitness trackers, even the kind of data that's being collected in our homes through our smart devices. So it's just really how data and fine amounts of data are being collected in all aspects of our life now that we're trying to uncover.
What are examples of the ethical obligations that researchers have, but that maybe even the companies themselves and the platforms have?
In the most classic sense, we have ethical obligations to not harming, you know, customers or our research subjects, trying to do good for society and make sure that we're doing positive things. And those guide research ethics overall, whether you're doing medical research or psychological research or behavioral research. We're trying to expand that and making sure that companies understand that the users of these platforms aren't just, you know, data subjects, that they are human beings and they have a right to dignity or a right to control over their information, and trying to sort of broaden out what these ethical obligations are. We're not trying to stop research from happening, certainly. We understand the value of the research that's being done. But again, making sure we have the right kind of frameworks in place so there aren't going to be any accidents or any kind of harm that's done intentionally or not.
So the project is starting now.
Right.
And when do you hope to start seeing, I don't know if results is the right word, but start seeing some real, what did I write before? Results.
Yeah. These things take time. I mean, many of us have already started this kind of work and we have things in progress. We'll probably start seeing the results from our first phase of research coming out next spring or next summer. And this is a four-year project, and we've laid out a pretty ambitious plan for what we're trying to accomplish. And it's going to include both academic outputs, but also guidance for researchers. We're hoping to have some meetings where we bring people together and even create some new kinds of best practices, maybe even, you know, some kind of a manifesto of big data ethics.
All right. Well, Michael Zimmer, thank you so much for joining us here on Link Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
Michael Zimmer is an associate professor at UWM. He's also director of the Center for Information Policy Research, which is partnering with five other research institutions for the Pervade project. There's more information about the research initiative at WUWM.com.
We'll turn to cybersecurity and the Internet of Things when Lake Effect continues in just a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Think about all the things you have that connect to the internet. Your smartphone and your computer, obviously. But then there's the fitness tracker on your wrist, or the app in your car that lets you check whether you've locked the doors, or maybe it's your TV set.
It is the Internet of Things, or IoT, and it's changed the way many of us live. But it's also exposed us in new ways to hackers and other people who might seek to do us harm. How safe are we in the IoT landscape? It is a question that Jen Rathburn wrestles with quite a bit. She's a partner at Foley and Lardner and co-founder of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So the Internet of Things has grown exponentially in recent years. Consumers have more and more internet-enabled devices in their homes and in their pockets, and businesses are using more of these as well. Let me start with a really simple and maybe obvious question. For every internet-enabled device, should we assume that there is someone out there working to exploit its vulnerabilities?
Most definitely, yes. In fact, at a lot of the large hacker conferences, such as DEF CON and Black Hat, many of those security researchers actually, you know, have sessions on how you can exploit those types of devices. And yes, unfortunately, those devices, you know, bring risk not only to consumers who use them, but businesses who purchase them.
I would be lying if I didn't say, as I was preparing for this interview, I was glancing at the Fitbit on my wrist and, you know, thinking about the kinds of data that it collects and what someone might want to do with that data.
Exactly. You know, I think one of the biggest issues with internet-connected devices is really consumer understanding about what data is being collected and how is that data being used. I mean, oftentimes, you know, when we allow someone to use our data through a connected device such as a Fitbit or others, we think, okay, well, they're using that data in order to provide us a service. But in fact, you know, oftentimes there are secondary purposes in which the companies are using that for. And so that's one of the things that is evolving in this space. And, you know, the FTC follows this because they have the responsibility for consumer protection, and the FTC has lots of recommendations. But essentially, it's, you know, how transparent are companies being with consumers about what types of data are they collecting and for what purposes are they using that data, and what consumers, you know, what consumer rights do consumers have to control that use of data?
Right. One of the distinctions that I was reading about is this idea that often you see that such and such a company will never sell your data to a third party. But that in itself doesn't necessarily mean they aren't sharing that data in some way, right?
Yes. It's also the age of big data. In addition to all of these devices being interconnected, companies are really focusing in on big data. And so the question is, okay, well, yes, you're collecting my data, and maybe you're not selling my data that's fully identifiable to a third party, but maybe that company is getting rights in that privacy notice to aggregate data or de-identify data. And, you know, one of the things, though, I would say that gets very confusing, and I work with a lot of companies on developing privacy notices, sometimes it's difficult for companies to predict how they're going to use data 5 years in the future, even 6 months from now. And so I would say that for both companies and consumers is really looking at that privacy notice. What are you putting out there? Are you being transparent? And the FTC is watching those privacy notices as well. Oftentimes, if there is a breach of information, a security incident, a hack, you know, the FTC will look at, well, what kind of privacy notice did you provide to consumers? Did you you know, promise that the security of their information would be protected, you know, in what manner?
You mentioned these privacy notices, and you know, they are often when we sign up for something online, we'll have to check that we've read and understand the privacy notices that they've provided for us. And realistically, a lot of us just click that box and go on with our lives. These privacy notices are not always written in such a way that's really easy for people. I would imagine even people who know the field to understand.
Yes, and that is one of the things that the FTC is trying to work on and give guidance to companies. I mean, consumers do have responsibility. You can't just say, well, I clicked on it. I have no responsibility. I don't know what happened. But that is definitely a problem. I mean, those consumer privacy notices, if you make them too complicated and consumers don't understand, then really, they're not useful in the end anyway. But that is the tug and pull in the space about what are consumers' responsibility and what are, you know, companies' responsibility with regard to providing consumers information about what they're doing with their data.
And I know you are not a computer engineer here, but one of the issues that I have read about in terms of security vulnerabilities that's apparently most common is, say, firmware that's not updated frequently enough. Where do things, in your experience, go wrong the most often?
Well, I think where things go the most wrong are when companies develop a device, they don't take security by design into consideration. And oftentimes, especially with startup companies or other things, they're just trying to take a product to market. And they're not thinking about, okay, well, this is a great product. It does all these wonderful things. There's all these benefits to business and consumers. But they don't think about, you know, what types of security vulnerabilities are in those products. How are we going to update and patch those products after, you know, their purchase? How long would we continue to do that? And what's so interesting about that is we have seen the Senate proposed a bill August 1st. It's called the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2017. And what's really interesting about this bill is, I mean, it's the first effort and push to try to protect internet-connected devices. And what this bill would require is that manufacturers that are selling IoT devices to government to, you know, implement certain security controls and think about things such as what you just mentioned. What are the security vulnerabilities? Are you going to be able to patch that device, you know, not using hard-coded passwords, you know, among other things? And really what we see in the legal space is oftentimes there are bills passed that affect government entities at first, but then those become standards that are pushed down to, you know, the private industry.
But again, this is where consumer responsibility comes into the picture as well. When a firmware update or a patch is available, there is some requirement on us as consumers to update it.
Yes, and that's where the FTC comes in. The FTC actually issued comments on the process aimed to improve the security of the Internet of Things back in June. And really what this was is a discussion about what should manufacturers tell consumers and what are consumer responsibilities. So, you know, one of the things they recommend to manufacturers, again, this is just guidance, it's not law, but when you see what the FTC comes out with guidance, manufacturers should take that into consideration because you know that if there's a issue down the road, these are the types of standards that the FTC is going to look at. And one of the things is, you know, does the device, can they receive security updates after it's purchased? You know, how will the consumer receive those security updates? And, you know, when will support of this device end? And I think that there is that pull and tug between, yes, manufacturer, you have to do security by design. You need to think about security vulnerabilities. You need to think of ways in which that device needs to be patched. But you also, consumer, we're not here to protect you for the rest of your life of this device. You know, you need to understand when maybe you have the responsibility to do updates, et cetera. And so the FTC is really trying to provide advice and commentary about how, you know, really these issues should be addressed.
Can you do a little dot connecting for us? I mean, I'm sure there are still listeners out there who are thinking, you know, who wants to hack my toaster or my thermostat or my light switch? What are the risks when you have an internet-enabled device, no matter how innocuous that device is?
Well, I think one of the best ways to understand the risks of IoT devices are, I mean, if you think about a virus or a disease spreading, when you connect to the internet and you have these devices, whether you bring them into your business or you bring them into your home, it allows someone to potentially come in and infect and get access to your data in many new ways than we used to see before. And, you know, sometimes hackers just want to do it because they just want to prove to the world that they're able to hack this device. I mean, that's one of the things in those big conferences that I mentioned. You know, companies will be sitting in there, and some of it is just security researchers proving that it can be done. But, you know, we worry about things such as medical devices and other things. You know, if someone can hack into, you know, a heart monitor or change dosing instructions and things like that, and, you know, it is possible. We know there's many cases that are out there of hackers being able to do, and it's just a reality. It's just another way to get in and affect a company's or a consumer's systems.
Right. This is akin to thinking about how, you know, a city's water supply might be maintained or electrical supply, right?
Exactly. And, you know, utility companies rely on lots of IoT devices as well.
And moreover, when it comes to home consumer devices, it sounds a little bit like, you know, the equivalent of leaving your back door open.
Very true. I mean, you need to – I always laugh, and we were talking about this earlier, like with great power comes great responsibility. When – I think this is a Spider-Man quote – when companies develop devices like this, I mean, they have the ability to do so many of amazing things, but manufacturers have the responsibility to think about, you know, the security measures that are in place, and consumers of which purchase these devices also need to take responsibility about understanding what that device does and what type of risk. I mean, there have been cases in the past. A lot of the FTC cases have involved, you know, in-home cameras, you know, that have been hacked where someone can view someone in their home, baby monitors, routers, you know, internet, you know, enabled TVs, you know, those types of things. So I think consumers need to understand when they bring that device into the home that they do have risk.
I know there are people who, you know, put just a simple piece of black tape over their over the camera lens on their smartphone or their laptop when they're not using it.
Number one thing to do, and I will tell you, you know, the FBI here comes out and does a lot of presentations. The number one thing you should do is on the camera on your laptop or anything like that, you know, is to put a cover on that camera phone, because that's one of the first things that, you know, hackers will look into doing.
As someone who specializes in this field, do you think twice or think more closely about which devices you want that have internet connectivity?
Most definitely.
I gather you took off the your fitness watch before you came over.
Yes, but I mean, I think about it. You know, when you know you enable a device to connect in, whether that's to, you know, your internet, you know, enabled watch, et cetera, you can often turn off settings of, you know, sending information back to the company. And so those are the things that I look at.
Well, and I gather things like fitness watches, you know, the Fitbit that I have on or whatever brand people have, many of them just have a Bluetooth signal that is on all the time and, you know, sends out location data to whoever is tracking such things.
Exactly. So does your phone, so do maps that follow you. And I just don't think the consumer awareness is really there. And I don't think consumers understand about how much information is being gathered about them on a daily basis, location data, health data, buying, you know, purchasing data, et cetera.
Well, these are all topics that we could get into the next time we chat. Jen Rathburn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jen Rathburn is a partner at Foley and Lardner and co-founder of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance. You can find links to more resources and information about cybersecurity and the Internet of Things at WUWM.com. Our interview first aired in August.
Another break now, and then a story about the surprising rivalry between moths and bats. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you walk near the lake at night, there is a good chance you'll see bats swooping through the air to feast on insects. What you might not see or hear is the aerial warfare at play, dividing the weak and the strong in a battle for survival that has spanned millions of years.
Tomorrow morning, Dr. Nicholas Dowdy will give a lecture on the evolutionary arms race between bats and tiger moths. It's the first of a series lunch and lecture presentations hosted by the Milwaukee Public Museum. Dr. Dowdy joins us now in studio. Nick, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, first of all, just to start here, what are tiger moths? How do they differ from, like, what I would consider a normal moth?
Well, tiger moths are an extremely diverse subfamily of moths. There are 11,000 species worldwide, and they're medium-sized to large moths, although some of them actually are very small, too, so they kind of span the moth size range, I guess. And visually, most of them are actually very colorful, so you might think of them more as, like, you know, quote-unquote butterflies. But, you know, butterflies and moths are actually both in the same group. They're both Lepidoptera. They're just separated mainly by whether they're active during the day or night in their evolutionary history. The other key thing about tiger moths is that they actually have the ability to produce sound in response to bat echolocation, and sometimes also in courtship. And that is pretty unique among moths.
So moths don't normally make sound.
So we're sort of still learning a lot about that. We do know that tiger moths do that, but we're sort of finding out more and more that other moths are doing that too. But the majority of moths out there, no, they're not producing sound that we know of right now. But the majority of moths actually do hear sound, which is really interesting.
So for tens of millions of years, tiger moths have been in competition in some ways with bats. You call it, in fact, intense selective pressure from bats. What do you mean by that?
Well, bats are very hungry, and they're very good at hunting insects. In my talk, I'm going to give some figures, but, I mean, basically, they eat a tremendous amount of insects. They, some people have estimated that they provide the United States alone about maybe $30 billion in biocontrol of pest insects, which is huge. And their ability to eat so many insects per night, I mean, that is the driver of evolution and natural selection. It's differential survivability. Do you survive or do you not survive? Can you live through a bat attack or not? And it's where that's where these anti-bat defenses really come into play. They help the moths survive that intense predatory selective pressure from the bats.
Are bats in particular attracted to tiger moths? Is there anything unique about them that would make them particularly delicious?
No, actually, there's a lot of things that make tiger moths particularly not delicious. I didn't mention this before, but another unique thing about tiger moths is that many of them, what we call sequester, or they basically take chemicals from plants to use in their own defense against bats. So as caterpillars, or sometimes even as adults, they will go to toxic plants and they will feed on them. And normally, toxic plants, they have these compounds to stop insects from feeding on them because they are very harmful to most insects. But tiger moths have special biochemical adaptations which allow them to not only overcome those plant defenses but also take those defenses for themselves and use them against their bat predators or even their invertebrate predators or bird predators too.
So this is one of the defenses they've built up over millions of years.
About 50 million years, yeah.
About 50 million years. And really what your lecture is about is all the different kinds of defenses they've developed. What are some of the other things they use to fend off bats?
So the key one is hearing. You've got to be able to hear the predator coming in order to do something about it. The second one is sound production. So once you know that the predator is coming, what are you going to do about it? In addition to sound production, what most other moths do is actually evasion. So this was something first studied in about the early 1960s by neuroethologist, which is basically just somebody who studies the neuronal basis of behavior. And they found that moths have two major evasive maneuvers. One is he called a turn-away behavior, which is sort of like if the bat is far away, you turn around and you fly in the opposite direction. Very straightforward, easy to understand. The other one is much more interesting and fun to study, and it's called evasive dives. So these are like when the bat is very close to the moth about to make a capture, the moth will do these crazy spiraling dives, and this allows the moth to make sort of a quick escape at the last second to get away from the bat. So there's been a lot of studies recently taking some new technologies like 3D videography and stuff and measuring flight performance of insects doing these dives and how effective the dives are versus when the insects are not doing dives, when they basically you take away their ability to hear the predator coming, and you can compare their performance with hearing and dives and without hearing and without dives. So that's really, really neat. Other sort of non-acoustic defenses exist as well, and I will talk about some of those. So recent studies have shown that Luna moths may be able to use those long tails that they have coming off of their hind wings as a diversion against bat attacks. So as the bat is coming in to attack the moth, instead of attacking the body of the moth, they may attack the tail instead. And I believe they found that with tails intact in their experiments, the moth survived about 60% of the time, which was great. Without their tails, they were captured like 80% of the time. So huge effect, it seems. Some other non-acoustic defenses. This one I'm really interested in, and that is like acoustic stealth sort of technology, which is really pretty crazy. So some researchers studied – this is actually another tiger moth. But instead of their sound production, they actually looked at the body covering of the moth. So moths are – pretty much all moths are covered in what we call scales. And they're sort of like little tiny pieces of exoskeleton shingled, kind of like on the roof of your house, maybe the shingles on your house. But in those shingles, they looked at the microstructure of those, and they found that they had this – really interesting sort of lattice structure. And they did some experiments and found that relative to a butterfly, which shouldn't be under any selective pressure from bats really, those particular types of scales absorbed bat ultrasound by 5 to 6%. So that decreased sort of the distance by which the bats could detect them by about 5 or 6%. So it's sort of like a like a B-2 stealth bomber, trying to hide from radar. It's the same idea, but it's in moth scales.
I'm talking to Dr. Nick Dowdy. He is currently working at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and he's about to give a lecture on moths, specifically tiger moths, and how they defend against bats. And so we have mostly insectivore bats around here. Do we have different types of tiger moths?
Oh, yeah. In Wisconsin, I don't know the exact number of species here. I mean, it's certainly not the most diverse place in terms of tiger moth diversity. You really have to go south to get that. But even in Wisconsin, I would say we have at least probably 10 to 12 species, which is pretty good. And a lot of those are producing sound in response to bat echolocation. There's actually also a surprising number of bat species in Wisconsin. I believe there's about like 11 or 12 of those too. So it's actually a really great place to be to study bat-moth interactions.
Is this something that people could see if they walked out to, say, the lake in a bat box, per se?
Yes, you could. You would need some special equipment, nothing too crazy. So you'd need like a flashlight or a headlamp to be able to see what was going on. It would be a lot easier to see the bats flying around and doing their thing. The moths are kind of small, and you need a trained eye to sort of see like, oh, yeah, that's this moth. It's hard to do at night when they're flying around. You can get there. I'm there, but it takes years to get there. Now, if you want to hear what's going on, so most of this is in ultrasound. So ultrasound means sound that is not audible to humans, which is above 20,000 hertz. That's the pitch is above there. There are things that you can buy to help you hear those things. We call those bat detectors. It's basically like a small box with a microphone and a speaker on it. And that microphone picks up the ultrasound and sort of slows it down and converts it to things humans can hear. And you'll hear little chirps and buzzes and things that the bats are making. So that's a lot of fun to check out.
All right. Well, Nick Dowdy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. And we look forward to the lecture.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Dr. Nick Dowdy is a postdoctoral research fellow working at the Milwaukee Public Museum. He'll deliver the first presentation for the museum's lunch and lecture series tomorrow at 11:30. There is more information at wuwm.com.
One last break, and then the man behind a new documentary about Bill Nye, the science guy. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. The TV show Bill Nye the Science Guy was a staple for countless kids raised in the 90s. He turned on a generation to science, demonstrating the way the natural world works in a way that kids young and old could understand.
Now, Nye, both his Science Guy persona and the man himself, is the subject of a documentary being featured in the 2017 Milwaukee Film Festival. The film is directed by Jason Susberg and David Alvarado.
Alvarado was in town for the opening of the documentary. He chatted with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz, first inside the Downer Theater, and then out in the warm autumn air to discuss how the project came to life.
I'm 33 years old. I'm on the older end of the millennial generation. And so, you know, we grew up watching Bill on TV or on VHS tapes in class. And Bill and the producers who made the show found this very unique way to make science not just interesting, but also fun and funny and engaging, and you wanted the next episode. You know, watching Bill Nye and on Saturday mornings was just like the highlight of my weekend. And so, having grown up in Dallas, Texas, I just seemed to leap out of the screen for me. The way of looking at the world where you care about the environment, you can understand the natural order of the universe through these fun and simple ideas, for me was just like, discovering a treasure.
So he was filling sort of a void or something that you really needed.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, in the film, for people who watch it, you'll see there's this community of Christians who are young earth creationists who believe the earth is something like 10,000 years old and that Noah's Ark was a literal event that happened very recently. And so, you know, that was the background that I came from. That was the community that I was raised in, not his specifically, but, you know, that type of belief. And we, you know, for me to get a different perspective, I guess really, called to me. And so it was really watching Bill and others like him on TV was just a total pleasure for me.
So all those years later, how did this project fall in your lap, or did you go after it?
Yeah, so the project began at the end of our last project. Jason and I, who's my the other director on this project, we made a film about these two scientists who want to reverse the aging process and make us live forever. It's called The Immortalists, available on Netflix. We're hungry for the next film because, you know, I mean, it's essentially to be an independent documentary filmmaker is that if you don't produce, you starve. And so we love science. We love documentary. That's the combination that we're interested in. So we were wondering what the next project was. And sure enough, this is 2014. Suddenly, we hear that Bill Nye had this debate with a creationist named Ken Ham. And it totally caught our attention, first of all, because like many other people, we thought Bill was dead. And so to discover, A, that he's alive, and B, he's kicking ass at science. Can I say kicking ass? He's kicking butt at science, just called to us right away. And so we reached out to his agent, explained who we were, set up a meeting, and essentially he wasn't hard to convince that there should be a film about him and that we are the right guys to do it. And so we got extremely lucky. I mean, looking back at it, I don't know why he said yes, but I think we're all glad that he did, for sure.
So how did the elements evolve? Clearly you had that element of creationist versus evolution, mm-hmm. but there's a very strong element of a climate change denier. How did those various pieces come in?
Into the film? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's only so many really important issues in science. I mean, there's a lot of issues, and there's only so many that hit the cream of the crop, and one of them is definitely climate change. And so, you know, Bill being a science educator and promoting science literacy, like the rest of us can see that there's a lot of denial about climate change being a human-caused thing. And so it was just obvious that we wanted to film Bill as he sort of butted heads with these people, not just to argue with them and see a brawl, but rather Jason and I were curious how people come to that perspective. I mean, it's as though people who weren't rocket scientists were arguing with rocket scientists about some very specific things. I mean, the people who research climate change and have dedicated their whole careers to understanding it know it at such an intimate, specific detail, at such a level of detail that it, you know, in order to argue with them, you'd have to be equally qualified, and most people who argue against it aren't. And so we just wanted to understand those people, where they're coming from. And it just seems to us like it's more of a political matter. I mean, it's not so much about the science for the deniers. It's about the policies. You know, they don't want the government regulating business. If you push them hard enough, they're going to say that. Even if you're trying to talk about science, if you push them on the science hard enough, they're going to eventually come down to regulation. And that's at the bedrock, I think, of what they're trying to do. And so witnessing Bill discover that for himself in the film, for us, was you know, a learning experience that we had, and we hope that people can share that experience.
So was it tough to get, is his name Joe Bastardi? Was it difficult to get him to participate in this, or was he say, did he say, bring it on?
Yeah, Joe Bastardi is a Fox News contributor and meteorologist who loves the weather. He loves the Earth systems, and just, you know, he's honestly in love with the weather. And so he's taken that passion, and his view of climate change is that it's not man-made, and if it is, it doesn't matter enough. And so, you know, he's been very vocal about that. When we first reached out to Joe, he was very hesitant for sure, but he was also, I think he just wanted to know that we were going to portray him honestly, which we have done to the best of our ability, and we think that he would agree. He hasn't seen the film yet. We keep inviting him out, but he's always busy doing one thing or the other. So, it was definitely, we had to convince him that we were going to do right by him and try to be honest.
So was it a coincidence, or did the planning sort of fall into place? Because then Bill Nye spoke at the university where Bastardi's son is a student, isn't that correct?
Yeah.
And that was an interesting dynamic, because his son talked about watching Bill Nye, very, very well aware of Bill Nye, and also being raised by his father. It was just such a subtle but powerful, just watching that young student was just an amazing process.
Oh yeah, the relationship between the father and the son. I mean, Joe Bastardi's son also doesn't believe in man-made climate change, and so part of the film is just a portrait of that family. And you know, we Jason and I really love that family. They're an amazing group of people, and they really care about each other and care about meteorology. That's a passion that they all share. It was a coincidence that Bill was there. I mean, Michael Mann is one of the leading climatologists who teaches at Penn State, and Bill and Michael Mann were close friends. Penn State happens to be where Joe Bastardi got his meteorology degree, and he still lives there, and so he's just a part of that community. It was sort of a microcosm for the larger issue of scientists who try to explain climate change and to people who deny it, mostly meteorologists. Which is interesting.
So this film was just meant to be somehow.
I guess so,
I mean,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So speaking of family, you mentioned before we, you know, turned on the microphone that getting to Bill Nye, the man, the, you know, when the camera's not on, was an evolving process for you. But there were some beautiful scenes with his sister, his brother. He spoke of his mother. That's a very compelling piece of that, going to his best friends for a holiday, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the film, I think, we tried hard to not to show you Bill Nye, the science guy, as you see on TV. You might have seen him as a kid, or you might see him on CNN today. That is what he does on the screen. But Bill Nye is also a human, a person like the rest of us. And so we did explain to Bill from the beginning that we wanted to share who he really was with everybody. And there's a funny, I guess it's a paradox, because Bill Nye, the science guy, is really who Bill Nye is, but also he isn't. I mean, he's an actor portraying himself on TV, and so it's hard to wrap your head around. I still haven't done it quite yet, but like, essentially, yeah, he really is authentically that science geek. If he was sitting here now, he would just be so excited to talk about the engineering and the different things in this room and try to get people to understand it. But at the same time, you know, when the camera's not on, he just, you know, he has the same vulnerabilities and limits to his energy and resources as anybody else. And so I think we captured a little bit of that in the film. Wait for these cars to pass.
So we stepped outside so you can get a little something to drink before you head back into the crowd in the film. So in later years, Bill Nye has become the CEO of the Planetary Society. Did that happen during the time that you met him or before?
He became the CEO of the Planetary Society right before we started filming, within a year, I think. And so when we started filming, one of the things that was happening was he was transitioning to this new persona, I guess. He was becoming Bill Nye, the CEO guy. And for us, that was just a real pleasure to watch because, you know, here he was, this guy who's totally experienced camera actor, but now he has to be a leader for an organization to actually do space missions. And so for us...
So he was on that board, and then yeah. He was convinced to make the move to... Exactly. To become the leader.
Exactly. So Neil deGrasse Tyson is another very famous science communicator who's also a PhD astrophysicist. He and Bill were on the board of directors, and at one point the organization decided it was time for a new CEO, and so Neil had to convince Bill. And so as the story goes, there was a lot of wine, and eventually Bill wakes up the next day and he's the CEO of the Planetary Society.
But he came at it at an exciting time. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I mean, the Planetary Society has a lot of missions. You know, they want to educate about space. They want to advocate for space exploration and politics. So they have a whole advocacy program where they go to senators and try to advocate for more exploration. And should I wait for this plane? Or?
No, it's fine. Okay. And Carl Sagan was the spirit behind the movement,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, Carl Sagan is the Bill Nye of his generation. He was the guy that made America fall in love with the process of science. And that had never quite been done before. I mean, there needs to be a whole separate film about him, actually. And this is back in the 70s at a time when scientists were in the mindset that science is for scientists and it needs to be kept away from the public. The public don't need to know. The public maybe doesn't even deserve to know. It's if you're doing science, you need to just keep it within the institutions. And Carl Sagan said, no, you know, there's no way that we can have a healthy society unless everybody understands what we're doing, that it will affect funding, that it will affect progress. And so Carl Sagan became this voice for science and got a lot of flack for it at the time. I mean, scientists basically started to think that he was just some kind of like TV goofball instead of a real scientist. So he paid a price. There's even a term for it in science, the Sagan effect. When you become too popular with your books or with your lectures, what have you, as a scientist, it's the Sagan effect. Suddenly you get shunned away from your scientists because you're not serious anymore because you're communicating it. And that's very, very concerning because the only way that our society is going to stay healthy and advance is if people understand science. So actually we need scientists to be communicating and getting people excited about it. And that's exactly Bill Nye's story. Bill Nye, you know, made a bunch of kids, now called millennials, excited about science and, you know, created a whole generation of kids who love it.
How important is it, particularly important, to be telling a story like Bill Nye's right now?
Well, we America. Part of the reason why America is the country that it is because we have this history of technological and economic development, which are very intimately connected. We live in a time, though, now where the strongest people in politics are pushing back against science and technology in this very unhealthy, very dangerous way. So we're at an interesting point in American history where people need to be better educated in science. People need to appreciate technology, solar, wind. These are all things that we should all be embracing, even genetically modified foods. For me, I think Bill's story is sort of a symbol for our time. We need to push back against people who deny science. We need to promote a better public understanding of science. And, you know, the only way to do it is to talk about it. And so this film, in some small way, talks about it.
And you don't have to wear a bow tie to do so.
And I refuse to wear a bow tie. I just cannot pull that look off. I haven't even really tried, but I just don't like the way it looks in my head.
When did he give you one?
Well, Bill Nye has his own line of bow ties made by a very excellent brand of bow ties, made by Joe Boxer. And he gave me one once as a gift, and I would have tried to wear it to this wedding that I was going to, but I just couldn't force myself to do it. And so I'm David Alvarado, the regular tie-wearing guy. And Bill should keep doing his thing, and I'll keep doing mine.
The documentary Bill Nye, Science Guy, will screen one more time at the Milwaukee Film Festival Tuesday afternoon at the Avalon Theater. David Alvarado directed the film. He spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz. And that's Monday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.